Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined today by Dr. Tom Mayer. And in continuation of the return of sports during COVID-19, we had the episode for ASAP 20 with our return to racing with NASCAR, the medical director for the AMR NASCAR safety team. And so we were involved there. And then through work with through the motorsports and sports and event medicine aspects of work with work within ASAP, I got in touch with Dr. Tom Mayer, who is has a close role with the most popular sport in the United States, and that is the National Football League. And so I reached out to him, and he graciously agreed to jump on the line here with us and giving a different angle of some of what emergency physicians are doing to fight and address COVID-19. So, Dr. Mayer, thanks for joining us here on ASAP Frontline.
Well, Dr. Stanton, thank you. Ryan, if you don't mind, and Tom, for me, it's a thrill. I was honored when you asked to have me share my thoughts. So it's really an honor to chat with you, and happy to answer questions or talk about anything you'd like.
Now, so what we're going to do is initially we're going to it's like a show here. We're going to set the scene. So give us an idea of and let all the listeners know your role with NFL as an emergency physician.
So I'm the medical director for the NFL Players Association, so the Players Union, which of course means we're the good guys. And so I represent 2,500 active players, their wives, their kids, and in many cases, their parents. So I'm one of the few emergency physicians that has, or physicians of any type, that has roughly 10,000 patients that I'm responsible for. So we negotiate with the league for, the league has a responsibility for providing a safe environment in which our players can play the extremely violent game of football. And my job is to hold them accountable for making sure that they do that. So I got the job in 2001, August 1st, 2001. Corey Stringer, a tackle for the Vikings, died of heat stroke, which is, even in 2001, 20 years ago, is inconceivable, particularly to emergency physicians and emergency nurses. But that's what happened. And Gene Upshaw, who is a Hall of Fame left guard from the Raiders and arguably the best left guard in the history of the game, but was the executive director at that time of the NFL Players Association. And Gene and I knew each other extremely well. His youngest and my youngest, Daniel and Gregory, were then and still are best friends. So he called me up and said, you got to step up and do the job. And I said, what job? He said, well, we're our medical director. I asked him what his current medical director thought about having me join. And he said, we don't have one, which was, even then, 20 years ago, surprising, to say the least. So since that time, I have represented the players, have been involved in, we actually drafted the first concussion guidelines for the NFL, monitored those, and did the same with COVID-19 when we first started, and involved a large number of emergency physicians in that operation. And as you probably know, there's a large number of emergency physicians involved in day-to-day operations as well.
So we've headed into 2020, and your season is just wrapping as the season for NASCAR is just starting. But, you know, getting into that mid to late February timeframe, we're keeping an eye on COVID-19. At that point, it's still, for the most part, a virus involving the Asian continent. And just kind of wondering where things are going. We wrap up the Super Bowl, and now we're heading into the spring and summer with plenty of time, thinking we've got time before we head into the onset of football in the fall. Tell us about those initial thoughts as we start to see numbers picking up here in the United States, and that window before the onset of training camp in the season.
Well, it's a great question. The season is almost year-round for us now, between all the issues that we had to deal with. But for context, as you may recall, we were in the midst of negotiating a collective bargaining agreement, or CBA, extension with the league. And that was hot and heavy and very intense. And we had our player representative meetings. Each club, we don't call them teams in the NFL, we call them clubs, elect their player representatives, three each per club. And we were in Florida, in Key Biscayne. We're negotiating the contract and coming up to a vote on what to do with the CBA. Obviously, I was following the COVID-19 coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, pick your way of referring to it, and went to our president, J.C. Tretter, who's a center with the Browns, and my boss now, who is our executive director, who is Demora Smith, because as you may know, Gene Upshaw passed away from pancreatic cancer, and told them in February this was going to be a serious threat to the NFL and a serious threat to the season. And Dee asked me to step up a task force of people who were internal to the NFL Players Association, meaning named to advise us, including Dan Hanfling, well-known emergency medicine and disaster medicine person, and a group of folks who had, like me, Dan was at the Pentagon on 9/11, as I was. And we needed a group of people that, as I've described numerous times, people ask me, well, what did they have in common? And the answer is they're all serious badasses. They're people who have been in the midst of crisis and dealt with crisis and managed through it. And therefore, this was not new to them to be able to say, against almost impossible odds, how do you play a season in the midst of a virus, which is a contact disease, meaning a proximity-based disease in a contact sport where people are literally swapping snot and hand fighting and high velocities and extremely large men. And so we ended up devising a system of testing, daily testing, as you may know. But that's sort of a chain that was the first link being testing, but running through protocols, guidelines, PPE, contact tracing, how the therapy would be handled, management would be handled, and all the issues that go with that. So far, fast forward after all that hard work, and we're 8 weeks into the season, and we have 80 players who have tested positive, which is 80 more than I would have liked. One is too many, but fortunately, they have done well. Only one has been hospitalized, and that was for a very brief period of time. And all of them have returned and are back playing football. So it appears that the sequelae, whether cardiac or pulmonary or neurologic, have been either non-existent or so low as to be undetectable. That said, we've got a long, long way to go, and we'll have to continue to, in the midst of the rising numbers that we're seeing nationally across the board in the general population, can we maintain that extremely low level of infection among our players? And fingers crossed, toes crossed, I carry my head around so I can knock on wood and make sure that we continue to do the best we can.
The late winter, early spring, we're seeing all kinds of cancellations from, I was sitting in a hotel in Atlanta in my fire suit ready to go to the track when he found out we were standing down, heading to the airport and getting out of town. Took about a two and a half month hiatus or so. And actually, it was 2 months almost exactly. And then you saw March Madness, you see delays in baseball, all these things going on. And you start seeing, the sports returning. MMA had an event just before the return of NASCAR. Shortly thereafter, you had some of the return of baseball and Major League Soccer. And you see some of these. And then, of course, with NBA, you see this idea of the bubble, smaller teams. And then you have to face that challenge. And I think it was the largest of the challenges of the sports, and that being with football. And you actually already mentioned the amount of contact, close proximity. This is not a sport that thrives well on social distancing. And, it's though for the wide receivers, that may be what they're trying to achieve, some distancing. But for the most part, this is a sport where opposing members are going to be right on top of each other for extended amount of times. And that seems to be a huge consideration. When you were starting to put together these plans, what were your thoughts in looking at these other sports, the potential of bubbles, and how to translate that into the most contact of contact sports in the U.S. landscape?
Well, we understood early on, as J.C. Tretter, our president, said, that you can't fit you can't say, well, how are we going to fit the virus into football? We have to fit football into the virus, into the broader context of what's going on. and begin to understand what it would look like to be able to protect our players. So we've advocated very strongly among our players. I always say to them, protect yourself, protect your family, protect your teammates, which is their other family. And by doing that, you'll be protecting football and protecting the community that you're in. It really took a level of detail and hundreds, if not thousands of hours of meetings, but of course those were Zoom meetings, that people argued out, discussed, had, as the State Department calls it, frank and open discussions, which I think means rip their lungs out in the State Department vernacular. But we fought it out in private in terms of what we thought needed to be done and what demands were there. For example, daily testing for the players was a bedrock principle they were not willing to back off from for a whole host of different reasons we can get into if you'd like. And that's been very successful. I think that's been the keystone to what we do. But that's why I say against almost impossible odds, the idea that you can individually wrap food and drinks and that you don't share Gatorade bottles or water bottles, that they're single-use bottles that are going to be used, that players, at least in the practice facilities on the field, are masking and are trying to maintain the appropriate distancing to the extent that they can. The fascinating thing, Ryan, to me, is that while we've had 80 players, and everyone knows we had an outbreak in the Tennessee Titans, the fact is that so far, this virus has not crossed the line of scrimmage. Not one player has contracted the virus from a player from the opposing club. And that's, I think, testimony to how hard people have worked at every single link in the chain to make sure that it doesn't transmit. Now, can I guarantee it's not going to transmit through the rest of the season? Of course not. But so far, that hasn't happened. And frankly, it's a very pleasant surprise to me, given the fact that when you know, the guys that have their hands in the dirt down on the trenches, the O&D linemen, linebackers probably next. I mean, they're face-to-face on every snap. And it's been impressive that we've been able to take care of that. Now, we play an outdoor sport, generically. Obviously, we've got indoor arenas. But even details like insisting that airflow indoors was turned up in the practice facilities, in the meeting rooms, and in the indoor stadiums. All the indoor stadiums are required to have a much higher air exchange than they normally would to assure that we get the best approximation to an outdoor environment, at least when it comes to virus being spread across the line of scrimmage. We haven't yet had to use, I immediately in February asked Oakley, who does our face eye guards, eye shields, to develop a face shield for O&D linemen and linebackers in the event that we had an outbreak and needed to say, how can we breathe with the volumes that we have, the tidal volumes, the air exchange, and yet have something to protect the face. Only a few players have worn those so far, but that's another contingency that's out there in the event that we start to see either the virus cross the line of scrimmage or spread among either O-linemen, D-linemen, or the folks in kind of the front box with their hands in the dirt.
You actually touched on it just a little bit, and I think it's a very interesting consideration. You know, in terms of the U.S. sports landscape, the NFL and Major League Baseball have the most robust players' associations and ability for collective bargaining, organization, working with their sanctioning bodies, as well as their, in your case, the clubs or teams or organizations or whatever it may be. You talked a little bit about it, but how is this coming together with the interest of the NFL as a sport itself, with their potential focus on getting product on field, getting product on TV, their ability to start getting that revenue stream going again, the NFL Players Association, that coming together? And was there anything that really, you mentioned the daily testing, but was how did that interaction and teamwork and Did it play out like a lot of negotiations with regard to salaries or practices or whatever it may be? Or is it something that was more like, hey, we're on the same team here. We're going to make this happen. And let's really walk lockstep here.
Yeah, it's a combination of both. It's an excellent question, Ed. And it really was a combination of both. And so having been involved in a number of crises, the inhalational anthrax crises in the nation's capital, I was the incident commander for that. I served as a command physician at the Pentagon, and Dan Hanflang, fellow emergency physician, was head of the USAR task force that was the first in to the Pentagon. And, you know, one of the things I always tell people is a crisis is a very, very bad place to try to figure out, you know, what's our mission, vision, and values? You know, what should guide us? How should we make decisions? And fortunately, with the NFL Players Association, again, I represent the interests, and not just me, but a team of people, that is that 2,500 players and the 10,000 number writ large, if you include their families. And we're guided by three fundamental principles. Number one, health and safety are non-negotiable. So we don't negotiate health and safety. We discuss it. We talk about alternatives. But when it comes down to the absolute of holding the league accountable for providing as safe an environment as possible in the midst of a global pandemic, we don't negotiate about that. Number two, we go where anywhere the science will take us, but nowhere the science doesn't. So God we trust, all others must bring scientific data to the table. So the league, for example, was kept saying, bubbles don't work, bubbles don't work, bubbles don't work. So the resistance to the bubbles didn't come from the players, it came from the league. And our answer to that was, show us the data. Show us the data that they don't work. And, of course, at that time, there really wasn't any data. And then the third principle is whole player, whole life, whole family. So we're passionate about not just the cost to the player of getting through a season and how many injuries they have. There's 2,500 active players. There's 7,700 injuries per year. So our injury rate is 100%. And when you start to think about that, it's not just that season, but it's the whole player, whole life, and whole family, so that we're looking at the impact on the family and the impact on this player for the rest of their remainder of their life. So there was a tendency at times for people to say, well, you know, they're young and healthy guys, just get back out on the field and everything will be fine. Well, as you might guess, that's not the way I approached it, and that's not the way our people approached it. Those things guided our negotiation, but so did the three things that we constantly say, which is that we have to move, and I think this is true in American healthcare writ large, even in emergency medicine, that we have to move from what's the matter with you to what matters to you. And I use that whenever I'm seeing patients, whether sports medicine or emergency medicine, pediatric emergency medicine, because there's a big difference in there, which I'm happy to elaborate on if you'd like. But that drives to a second piece, which is that moves the patient from being a recipient of care to a participant in their care. And then finally, nothing about us without us. Nothing about the care and feeding and protection of NFL players without the input of the NFL players who are being cared for. And once we made that clear, not just to the league, because my counterpart with the NFL, his interest, of course, are the owners, the 32 owners. And as you said, playing the games, getting the maximizing revenue, maximizing the number of games. It's not that they're not interested in player health and safety, but as you know, that's a different interest. And it really worked extremely well by just sticking to our guns and sticking to our principles. And I'm sure at times those negotiations, they got pretty sick of me talking about our mission, vision, and values and moving from what's the matter with you to what matters to you. But it served us extraordinarily well. And we kept our players constantly involved so that people like Richard Sherman and Pat Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers and on down the list, all of whom are player representatives, by the way, were highly informed about what was going on. Their questions were answered. And the most lethal part of our negotiations is a well-educated player, a player who's as smart about healthcare as they possibly can be. So they don't have to rely on me or our team of people to say what we should or shouldn't do. They've already been educated ahead of time. So it's been a real blast.
I know right before we got on the call, we talked about the fact that, you know, our season just wrapped up, and I'm just like taking a little bit of a breath, even though we just started conversations today on next season. So you're right. Everything is about year round, but, you know, it's you guys are in the midst right now. And actually the Titans are my team growing up in Tennessee. So that one hit a little bit home. But you touched on, you know, the values, what's important to the individual, the shared decision making. And one thing that I've really liked and thought was really good was giving the players the opportunity and support to weigh the risks and benefits in their own mind, not saying we're all going to play or none of us are going to play this season, and getting that opportunity to opt out. And there was a lot of reasons, and we've heard stories, you know, about potential sick family members, concerns about family, concerns about personal health. How important, as you mentioned, those values for the NFL Players Association, was that opportunity to say, this is a sport, it's a career, but this is also a sport, and each of us individually has to weigh that risk and benefit for ourselves to determine if we go into the 2020 season.
Well, it was such a joy to be able to work with these guys, because I used a term, and I still use the term, that our players use all the time, which is when it comes down to negotiations and do this or don't do that and what the workouts were going to look like and preseason games or no preseason games. The players would say, you know, listen, we're grown-ass men. You know what? We're grown-ass men, and my opinion is, if you take grown-ass men and you educate them and give them as much information as they can, because to me, they're all player patient, not just players, but player patient. If you give them the right information, they'll make the right decision, and they did. Now, some of them, as you know, chose to opt out. And as a matter of fact, you probably know this, but the precise number of men who played in the National Football League is a little over 24,000 in the history of the game. And of those 24,000, how many play football while they were a doctor? Now, many of them became doctors after they retired from football, but there's only one, and his name is Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. He was the starting right guard for the Chiefs. He's got a Super Bowl ring. He is graduated from medical school and continues to play football. And I might say, is for some reason, has chosen me as a bit of a mentor. So we're working hard to get him to go into emergency medicine. And I think he's decided that's what he wants to do. But he opted out this year. He decided not to play. Didn't have any of the, you know, diabetes or sickle cell disease or chronic lung disease, asthma, those kinds of things that were the medical opt-outs. So he walked away from $2.4 million and said, and his reasoning was very simple. It's almost heartbreaking. You know, he said, Tom, or Doc, he always calls me Doc. But Doc, I couldn't live with myself if I had transmitted that virus to another player, either on my team or to someone else. Now, he hasn't had COVID, but that's the level of integrity. You talk about mission, vision, and values. This is a guy who's volunteering by working in a nursing home, despite the fact he's got an MD, because he hasn't done his residency yet, of course. And you know, it's just touching when you see people do things like that and say, I'm not willing to participate in something that might transmit the disease to the men I work with on an ongoing fashion. So it's, I don't know. I think that when I talk to emergency physicians, critical care, neurocritical care, it's brought out something, the pandemic has brought out something very strong in ourselves, particularly in emergency physicians and nurses, ICU nurses. As you know, some of the stuff that we see, particularly having to have these patients in a prone position where you can't look in their eyes, having them be in the ICU and not be able to see their relatives, literally see their relatives, meaning not just not in the room, but they can't see him. And yet it's brought out something, I think, both in the American people and particularly in their appreciation of the heroes of healthcare, who are the frontline workers, who are emergency physicians and the nurses and colleagues that we work with. And it's just, it's humbling, I think, to be a part of emergency medicine.
I actually saw the story of his commitment to the nursing home. And actually, I think they did a special feature on that with the return of football on that game one. And it was actually really neat to see that. And I hope I look forward to him being an emergency physician, of course. That's the perfect mindset for emergency physician. We are those kinds, the adrenaline junkies and thrill seekers, and nothing more than that than an NFL player. Let's talk about one of the things that so NBA had the bubble. General public has isolation and social distancing and all those things. And you've seen a lot of talk about whether we're going to play in one city, whether there was going to be, try to do the bubble, whether you're going to have isolation, how are you going to do everything. But with NFL, one thing that can't be really changed, because it's all across the country, is that limitation or restriction of travel, and then the communities where you're going to be. And with our evaluation, bigger concern a lot of times was much higher rates of COVID within the communities that we're going to than any time within the sport itself. So how did you tackle that potential of not just being in the stadium, on the field where you can control that environment for the most part? How do you address that potential risk exposure of the natural travel and interactions and city hopping of the NFL?
Well, when it comes to the season itself, instead of flying on one plane or two planes, players are it's every other seat, including first class. So they typically charter an aircraft. Almost all of them use wide body aircraft for a host of different reasons, including the wide bodies of our guys. But so there were changes in terms of how you fly, for example, from stadium to stadium. So think about it, and I'm sure you have, as a bubble, in turn, meaning that we are limiting the possibility of transmission within the building by testing and all the other stuff that we've done, physical distancing and mask wearing and all the issues that go with that. And then you extend that and say, okay, now we're going to have to say, how do we reduce the risk of transmission outside of the building? And I think that's education and talking to I have a call every month with what's called the Ladies Council, the wives and women of our players, and to talk to them about what's at risk. And they have questions about everything, including the kids and interactions and which do they let the kids go to school and all kinds of things like that. But the idea of reducing transmission goes down to the level that teams, once they arrived wheels down in the city that they're playing their game at, got on two buses and went to their hotel. Now they're required to use a minimum of five buses. The drivers have to be tested ahead of time. They maintain physical distancing as well as masks, and then drive that all the way through their stay at the hotel. The end of the game, the lockers, every team has to name an infectious disease person on site that's responsible for running their program, in addition to the emergency physicians who are already involved in the sideline care in the NFL, and filed what we called an EIDR, Infectious Disease Emergency Response Plan, which essentially is an EAP for COVID, both at their home facility as well as their travel, and as well as when they're on site. So the details that you have to think about and go into are impressive, but they're also predictable, because football, like racing, I think, is kind of a creature of habit. People have very rigid schedules by which they go, what they do when they travel, where they are going to stop, if they have to stop on the way, all those kinds of things. And the same is true of our men in the league. They don't tolerate ambiguity when it comes to their schedule particularly well, which has the side effect of us being able to predict what's going to be done fairly well. And again, as I said, so far it's worked out great, but we got a long haul to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last question I want to wrap up with today is, I know that we both love our jobs, and what we get to do and the unique environments in which we get to practice. And but this is also an opportunity for to do something, to achieve something, and to plan something that can be replicated across the country. And with the return of sports within the collegiate, high school, or other areas, how do you feel that the work that you've done with NFL and the NFL Players Association and the work otherwise will translate into addressing COVID-19 within sports of all levels in the United States and beyond?
Well, I think it's a sport just as your sport is as well, something that you know has a fan base which is phenomenal, rabid, and dedicated. So the good news is, I think there is a bit of a halo effect for both of us in being able to say, you know, what seems impossible isn't, number one. Number two, how do you get there? It's same way we practice emergency medicine. Life isn't a surprise to us, at least not after the first couple of years. You kind of know what's coming through the door. I always tell my residents, when you see a patient, tell them, you know, we knew you were coming. We just didn't know your name. And that's true of emergency medicine, because you know what the, you know, belly pain, chest pain, you know, trauma, pediatrics, that's what we're going to see. We just don't know the names of the people. And what I think is fun about the positions that you and I are in, and particularly your position with the board, is, you know, it's gives you a chance to take the bully pulpit a bit and say, you know what? Yes, we have resources in racing. And yes, we have resources in football that, you know, other sports don't have, and high school sports and even NC2A. Look at the decimation of some of the seasons by the large number of people that they've had. But it just, you know, I think emergency physicians bring hope. And I think that it's been a privilege to bring hope when it comes to, yes, it can be done. And what it takes to get it done is to think it out ahead of time, to have a clear sense of mission, vision, and values, what we stand for. And then the disciplines, you know, the disciplines, not just of clinical care when it comes to the virus, or clinical care when it comes to how we're going to take care of a trauma patient or a cardiac resuscitation, but the disciplines of how we're going to talk to the patient and how we're going to interact with the family. So I think there is a halo effect. You know, we always say we represent the interests of the NFL athletes, but, you know, there's kids in high school now that will end up being my player patients 8 years down the line. And don't know who they are, but I know there's a bunch of kids out there with dreams in their eyes that they want to do it. And anything that we do that helps them maintain that dream, cultivate that dream, and live that dream, we want to do. And that includes doing the best we can to make sure that from Pop Warner on up, that opportunities are advanced that people might have thought weren't possible, and that, for example, there wouldn't be an NFL season. So a lot more to come, but those are my thoughts.
Talking with Dr. Tom Mayer, the medical director for the NFL Players Association, and chatting about the return of football, and now as we record this mid-season, just a phenomenal job at not only this but also service to our country prior, and then to emergency medicine. And I really appreciate your time and talking with us and being so open and honest about the about your efforts at bringing in those of your teams and the clubs and your sports around you at bringing the NFL back to TV. So, Dr. Mayer, thank you very much.
Ryan, thank you, and thank you for your leadership. I think people who don't know what the board does don't understand that. Whenever I lecture at Scientific Assembly or anywhere else, I always tell people to reach in their pocket and pull out whatever wad of cash they got, and realize that about a third to half of that came from the American College of Emergency Physicians and their advocacy on behalf of our patients and on behalf of our emergency physicians. So thanks for what you do.
I appreciate that very much, and support everything, and hope to talk to you down the road. And Maybe once we get through COVID, I can join you at a game, and I'll bring you out to the race, and we can share notes at some point.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks so much.
All right, take care. And as for me, you can contact me at youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, at EverydayMed on Twitter. I also invite you to subscribe to the ASAP Frontline podcast. We do have the weekly releases, some great talent we've brought in. It's allowed us to really reach out with the virtual context of which we do a lot of our recording now. And really looking forward to what we bring in the future, looking at different opportunities for emergency physicians, the evidence, the education, the information, and everything that we can do to help make the lives better for physicians, other providers, healthcare professionals, and of course, and most importantly, the people that we get the opportunity to take care for, to take care of. Until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline. And in the side